Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. There's the ocean, the universe, and the brain, three still largely unexplored realms. But doors are opening in the brain, and some neurological conditions that have plagued us are now being treated by many ways, but one in particular with a technology called deep brain stimulation. We've talked about it on the program before. Joining us in the studio to continue the conversation is Dr. Ali Rezai. He is director of the Center for Neuromodulation at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. He is known around the world for his work in deep brain stimulation. He was named one of the best doctors in America in Castle and Connolly's Guide to America's Top Doctors for 2001 through 2013. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Describe again what we mean by deep brain stimulation and what you're doing.
Well, deep brain stimulation is essentially a pacemaker for the brain. So we implant a pacemaker in different parts of the brain to treat patients who have suffered for many years, for example, Parkinson's disease or patients with chronic pain. We've done these implants for those with severe obsessive compulsive disorder, depression. There's trials going on for severe addictions. We're doing trials at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center for those with severe obesity, Alzheimer's disease, autism. There's a number of applications, but the most common one is for movement disorders and Parkinson's.
All of this is at first possible because we now understand more about how much the brain is controlling
these
conditions.
Yes, there's tremendous advances in the neurosciences and technology that allows us to understand the function and malfunction of the brain. So the overall understanding of the brain networks or regions in the brain involved in movement, for example, that are impaired in those who have tremor or Parkinson's or a condition called dystonia, or different parts of the brain involved in anxiety and mood. And those parts are involved, if there's damage there, it's causes depression or obsessive compulsive disorder. So the more we understand the brain and its functioning and malfunctioning, the more we can treat patients using these new technologies.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Ali Rezai. He is the director of the Center for Neuromodulation at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. You've said the goal is to help people live better lives no matter their age. And a lot of the people that you've, age is not a consideration per se. How do you determine when someone's a good candidate for this sort of surgery?
Well, it depends on the condition. And you're right, age, we have done surgeries on patients as young as 7 years old and as old as 91, an individual who wanted to improve his golf game and he had severe tremor. So he had a brain pacemaker to help improve his tremor. But basically, in general, patients have to have had tried medications and other approaches first. So this is not a first line of therapy. It's for those who have tried medications and other approaches and they have failed those, or despite the best medications and other approaches, their quality of life is getting progressively worse and they're becoming more disabled, and this becomes an option at that time.
I know it's very expensive, of course, but why not a first line of approach? Why not, or a first line of therapy?
Well, it is brain surgery, so you want to wait until you've tried medications and more standard basic approaches. But for example, Parkinson's, we've been doing this now for 16 years, and now we're getting more and more patients who are early on in their Parkinson's and they don't want to take medications for years, so they come to us earlier and earlier. So as the technology is evolving, people are coming for this surgery earlier.
Does the surgery itself and what you're doing with deep brain stimulation, let's talk about Parkinson's for a second. It's stopping the symptoms of, or it's addressing the symptoms of Parkinson's or reducing them. Is it actually treating or having an impact on the disease itself?
That's a great question. For the most part, we are treating the symptoms like the tremor, the stiffness, the walking problems of Parkinson's. But there are some camps across the world that think that we're actually slowing down the progression of Parkinson's. But fundamentally, we're basically treating the symptoms of the disease.
Yeah, because I read that it's the neurons, they're able to grow new neurons?
The neurons, there are studies that show plasticity in the brain with neurostimulation.
Okay.
So, for example, studies are showing that you get new generation of neurons by stimulation in the memory parts of the brain or different parts of the brain. So yes, neurostimulation or brain pacemakers can change the function of the neurons and can also induce growth of neurons and making new connections.
Now, I think you're under 50, right?
Yes.
Still, right, pretty young. through in your career, as you've studied and started to study this, when did the whole brain plasticity idea come to the fore in as far as your career goes? When did that start to change things?
Well, really, it's a great question because for many years, people thought that the brain is static, so there's no plasticity. But really, for the past 20 years, there is tremendous growing evidence that the brain is very dynamic and is evolving. So let's say somebody has a stroke, a part of the brain is damaged, or somebody with traumatic brain injury, there is significant potential for the brain to have plasticity, meaning that parts of the brain can change and take over the functions of the damaged brain. So this potential for plasticity needs to be augmented to help patients suffering from stroke or other neurological conditions. It's a major phenomenon now.
Yeah, and it's really directed a lot of your entire career so far. It's been kind of fundamental to what you do.
Tremendously. And basically, these brain pacemakers are rewiring the brain in some ways and helping these patients from a whole host of neurological and psychiatric and other disorders.
So, you know, you call it a pacemaker. You're actually putting wires into the brain.
Correct.
Using robots.
Right.
I wanted to talk about the robots in a little while. But how do you know where, for instance, if you're talking about obesity, you're doing some trials with severely obese people, where would you put the wires in the brain?
So it really depends on where the problem is. Somebody's got Parkinson's, there are parts of the brain that are involved in the movements, and those parts are where we implant these tiny wires. If somebody has got severe addiction, or in the cases of obesity patients, there are areas in the brain involved in the impulsivity and the reward-seeking behavior, habit formation areas. And those are the parts that we map, and then we place the pacemaker. In the case of Alzheimer's, there are areas that are involved in cognition and brain connectivity. And so these pacemakers can block the abnormal activity in the brain or augment the activity, facilitate connectivity, and really normalize or regulate the imbalance in the brain causing many different conditions.
What are you putting in the brain with these wires to augment or to repress something?
So the brain is built of hundreds of billions of neurons with trillions of connections, and the connectivities via electricity. So the brain's language is electricity and chemicals. So these pacemakers use electrical signals to regulate the brain, and they regulate in different ways by augmenting the activity if it's low, or inhibiting abnormally excessive activity. Like in Parkinson's, there's chaos in the brain, and these pacemakers calm the chaos in the brain. Or in the case of an imbalance in the brain, they normalize the brain more. So we can use different settings with these pacemakers, depending on the underlying disease, to help improve the function of these patients.
And when you talk about a pacemaker, I think of something that's installed in somebody's body to control the beat of their heart. Where is the pacemaker? Where is the gadgetry for this?
So really, it's in the same location. These current pacemakers, they're in the chest, right below your collarbone, exact same location as a heart pacemaker. The wires, however, go into the brain. Now, recently, last month, the FDA approved a new generation of brain pacemakers, which were involved in the research of those, that basically the pacemakers are implanted in the skull. So they're the size of a small pocket watch, and they get implanted in the skull, and the pacemaker can sense the electrical activity in the brain for those who are having seizures and detect the electrical storm before it gets generalized, it senses it, and then shuts it down. So that's the new generation devices that are out there. But the current...
They can anticipate.
Correct. This is called a feedback loop, a closed-loop device. So like a heart pacemaker can detect a life-threatening heart rhythm and shut it down. Same thing right now with neurological pacemakers. We can detect the abnormal electrical activity in the brain, for example, during seizures or those with severe Parkinson's, and then regulate it in a closed-loop sensing and feedback mechanism, which is really a new way of treating patients.
And that's the FDA has approved this or approved it for study?
The FDA has approved this device now for epilepsy. So it's a landmark. It's the first device in the neurological pacemakers that is able to sense and stimulate at the same time.
Drugs for seizures, drugs for people who suffer from seizures due to epilepsy, they can be very debilitating themselves. Is that something that they continue to take, or can they stop taking them?
For the most part, the patients, they continue taking the medications. But the drugs, as you stated, they can be very debilitating. They can cause gastrointestinal side effects, cognitive effects. They can cause sleep disorders. So medications are very effective, and I think they should be the first line of therapy. But medications are very generalized. For example, when you take a pill, it goes to your stomach and it gets into your bloodstream and covers your whole body from head to toe. And then it gets to the brain via the blood-brain barrier and exerts its mode of action. In contrast, a neurological pacemaker or a neuromodulation device goes to the problem area directly with an implant that delivers the drug to that location that's malfunctioning or sending electrical signals that are calming the activity. So drugs are very general therapy. Imagine if your car has run out of gas. It's like bringing in a big tanker truck full of gasoline and pouring gas over the car until it gets into the carburetor and runs the car again. Our approach is taking the syringe and needle directly into the carburetor and making the car get going again.
So why continue the drug therapies, though, if you have the deep brain stimulation?
Well, I think that we need a multifaceted approach. So it requires medications and a pacemaker and other approaches to really provide the best approach for the patients, best tailored treatment for the patient.
And how do you decide, well, going back to the issue of who gets to have the surgery, how you decide, how bad does it have to be? I mean, you had the 91-year-old fellow who just wanted to improve his golf swing. Of course, there's probably a lot more in his life that he wants to improve besides the golf swing. But how do you decide it's bad enough that it would require brain surgery?
Well, really, it depends on each individual's perspective of their disability.
Okay.
We've had patients who've been in wheelchairs and they were fine functioning like that. And we've had people who were pilots, for example, or physicians or photographers, and they had a little shaking, a tremor, and that was life disabling for them. So in general, it depends on each patient's life, but if somebody's having problems with shaking, for example, or cannot walk, or has stiffness, rigidity, they're freezing, they're not able to move, and they've tried a reasonable attempt at medications, they're not getting better or having side effects, then surgery may be an option for them. And we also mentioned medications before. Over time with these surgeries, as we put the pacemakers and adjust them, we typically reduce the medications. So our goal is to reduce the medications as we adjust the pacemaker.
We're talking with Dr. Ali Rezai. He is the director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page, too, and see a picture of Dr. Rezai there, or just post your question or comment. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour is Dr. Ali Rezai. He is the director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. What they do, his work, he's best known for his work in deep brain stimulation. That's what we've been talking about. It's maybe you could just describe it very quickly once again. It's like a pacemaker for the brain.
Exactly.
But you were talking off the air about how they're looking at using this for things other than the brain now, too.
Right. So with this technology, it's not only limited to the brain, but these pacemakers are used to treat chronic pain with spinal cord stimulators. They're used in peripheral nerves that control your muscles and movements for the treatment of stroke, for the treatment of headaches and other chronic pain conditions. They're FDA approved for the treatments of urinary incontinence. They're being used for gastric disorders. They're being explored for heart failure, irritable bowel syndrome. And they're also being used for those with retinitis pigmentosa and blindness. So it's a whole host of activity utilizing these pacemakers all over the body.
It's funny, we usually refer to things as the miracle drug. And this feels like the same sort of thing, but it's sort of like the miracle procedure.
Well, it's taken some time. If you want to look at, for example, heart pacemakers, and they were developed, the first device was developed in the late 50s and 1960, and that really revolutionized the way heart conditions are treated. In the neurological arena, we're about 30 years behind, but in the same way that these heart pacemakers revolutionized the treatment of heart disorders, neurological pacemakers are transforming the way we treat neurological conditions. And also there's this very active brain-body axis. So all your body organs are controlled by the nervous system. So we can use pacemakers to treat heart disorders now, treat bowel disorders and many other conditions. So it's really a big frontier for exploration for the future.
Right. I mean, just you mentioned the brain plasticity and the whole issue of what the brain is causing. 15, 20 years ago, when I would do a story on eating disorders, it was about behavior. And the last time I did a story about it, a show about it, it had a lot more to do with the brain.
Exactly. So our advances in understanding of the neurosciences and the new technologies like imaging, genetic analysis, cellular biochemistry, and the computing power, analytics, is allowing us to understand brain function and the networks involved in the brain. So we know regions involved in movement, regions involved in sensation, areas involved in cognition, in decision-making, areas involved in behavior, memory, fear, anxiety, impulsivity. So these networks in the brain are being determined better than any time before. And as a result, we're able to help many more patients. And it's not just treatments, it's prevention, detection, monitoring.
There can be an immediate effect from the surgery, and sometimes it takes longer. Are you seeing any patterns for the reaction time to the surgery? Depending on what it is, whether it's Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or obesity, do you see different patterns?
Absolutely. So, for example, with Parkinson's or someone who's got tremor, the effects are immediate. We see the benefits as soon as we implant the pacemaker during surgery, and the patients are awake because we're mapping the brain. So as soon as we implant the pacemaker, we can see the tremors stop, or we can see the patient's rigidity melt away. And it's very profound for these patients who've had these conditions for decades and are able to witness immediate changes with the flick of a switch. In the case of Alzheimer's, these are investigational trials that we're doing. In the case of traumatic brain injury, these are more gradual changes. So as the behavior and the cognitive areas are being modulated, this takes more time. In the case of obsessive compulsive disorder, in the clinical trials we've done, or for depression, those are also gradual. So I would have to say the most immediate are in the case of movement problems, like a tremor or Parkinson's, and the rest of them take time.
Some of them are like flipping a switch. Others are like retraining a muscle.
Absolutely.
Okay. Rachel in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, along with a few other mental illness issues. So my question is, will the deep brain stimulation eventually be able to treat multiple mental illnesses?
That's a great question. The deep brain stimulation is FDA approved for patients with severe obsessive compulsive disorders, the patients who have problems with checking and washing and the obsessive compulsive behaviors that have become disabling. It's also being explored in various clinical trials around the world for those with severe depression, as well as those with addictions, whether it's alcoholism or drug addictions. And it's being explored for a number of other conditions like patients who are bipolar or have schizophrenia or others. It has not been explored for borderline personality disorder, but application of these devices for patients with behavioral mental disorders is significantly improving and advancing. So maybe in the next few years we'll know more, but it is FDA approved for those with severe obsessive compulsive disorder.
All right, Rachel, thanks a lot for that call. Erin in Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome, Erin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Doctor, I have been in recovery from alcoholism for quite a while, and my father and grandfather both had alcoholism and were able to get sober, but not through any of this wonderful technology you're talking about. I noticed at the beginning you were talking about how it has to be quite an advanced stage, but then later on you were talking about the possibility of prevention. I see patterns in my own teenagers that make me think their brains may be susceptible to addiction. And I wonder, how soon do you see this being more preventative? Because why would you let someone progress in addiction if there's a very strong predisposition?
Right. So with the prevention, we were talking in general about advances in neurosciences are allowing us to understand patients, for example, who are genetically predisposed to addictions or depression or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. It's not per se adding these pacemakers as a preventive measure, but it's more about detecting the condition genetically or with brain imaging. But you're absolutely correct in terms of alcoholism and addictions. or any kind of addiction, every time an individual takes alcohol, for example, or a drug, it releases a chemical called dopamine in the brain, and continuous exposure to this can result in the habit formation that changes the actual brain activity. So many studies are showing that the brain's region involved in reward and impulsivity actually changes over time with continued exposure to drugs and alcohol. So no question, these parts of the brain are being rewired with exposure to alcohol or other drugs.
Thanks a lot, Aaron, for that call. Crystal in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Ali Rezai. He's director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. Hi, Crystal.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
My question, I had two questions. One was, is this being used in the treatment of neuropathy? Mostly diabetics get this condition. I'm not diabetic, but...
Could you say what neuropathy is, Dr. Rezai?
So neuropathy is when you have damage to the nerves, hence the term neuropathy, and that can be caused by trauma, that can be caused by diabetes, that can be caused by a whole host of other conditions. Often we don't know why, but it can get damage to the nerves that results in a neuropathy, which means pain in the area that the nerve is supplying, and that can be hand pain, foot pain, other types of pain syndromes. And definitely this technology has been applied for patients with severe neuropathy, including diabetic neuropathy, who have failed medications. And these are not actually brain pacemakers, but they're nerve pacemakers. They're much more simpler, and we do this routinely for various types of neuropathies.
And she was also going to ask about serotonin levels.
I didn't get the question.
Well,
sorry.
She was going to ask about neuropathy and serotonin levels. Is there a connection there?
Oh, well, sure. Well, serotonin and different chemicals in the brain or even the nervous system, dopamine or serotonin, are involved in various elements of chronic pain and also behavioral conditions. And no question, neurostimulation is changing the neurotransmitter levels. It's changing, for example, dopamine, serotonin, and other transmitter levels in the brain and nervous system.
Thanks a lot, Crystal, for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. I guess maybe we'll go back to something that maybe Aaron brought up. Could these treatments be used preemptively to forestall what might hurt a brain earlier and might have hurt a brain earlier in life and predispose it to, say, something like Alzheimer's or use it to repair or forestall any long-term damage from a concussion and that sort of thing?
So we've been exploring a clinical trial at Ohio State for the past 3 years with Dr. Corrigan and Miss Yu at Ohio State University, looking at those with severe traumatic brain injury, those who are a decade since their severe brain injury and very damaged, to see if we can improve the recovery. And our early results are very promising for these patients. We're very excited about the potential of using these brain pacemakers to facilitate recovery from traumatic brain injury. And I think that you can also facilitate recovery from those suffering from a stroke. So what happens from a traumatic brain injury or stroke? A part of the brain is damaged, for example, areas involved in cognition, speech, or movements. And we think this technology has significant potential for facilitating recovery of these patients, whether it's their movement recovery, their cognitive recovery, or behavioral recovery.
How soon after something like a stroke damages the brain can you go in and perform this kind of surgery?
At this point, we have to wait to allow for spontaneous recovery. So the brain often recovers by itself, whether it's a trauma or a stroke. So typically, we don't do these procedures for at least a year or two because you need to have a window which would allow the normal recovery process of the nervous system. And that can be significant for patients. So you don't want to go do a brain surgery for a patient that can have normal recovery. So you want to wait a couple of years until the recovery has basically been maximized, the spontaneous recovery, and then this may be an option for patients.
Raymond in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Raymond.
Thank you. I have a question or two for the doctor. I have chronic cluster headaches nearly 27 years now, and medically, drug-wise, nothing has been very helpful. Imitrexon in emergency, oxygen inhalation to abort. But I was wondering if you could discuss how I do know that this is being done for some cluster headache patients, but how the placement in the hypothalamus modulates that condition and what the state of the art is at the moment.
Right. So cluster headaches is a terrible headache, is one of the most disabling headaches. They call them also suicide headaches. They're extremely painful, pain around the bridge of your nose, around your eyes, often associated with tearing, with swelling of the eyes, and fairly common, and they're excruciating pain. Now, to the point that across the country and worldwide, there's been brain implants in the region of the brain called the hypothalamus to control it. However, we also have been involved in new studies where we developed a microchip that gets implanted above your first molar. It's really a dental implant that gets into the sphenopalatine ganglion, a nerve cluster of nerves right outside your teeth. And we've done this clinical trial in Europe with this new dental implant that gets activated with your cell phone. So we've shown in cluster headache patients that 60% of patients can stop their cluster headaches within 15 minutes of using their cell phone therapy. So this is a really exciting area of research for us with these micro implants that we're not going to the brain, but outside the brain. And this is actually approved in Europe as a standard clinical approach for those with severe clusters. And the FDA has given permission for this to also be studied in the U.S. now with a clinical trial. So I think there's a lot of hope for patients with cluster headaches to use their cell phone device to stop their cluster headaches.
In other words, they can control it.
Absolutely. So when they feel the headaches come on, they use their cell phone and stimulate to block the headache signals.
All right, Raymond, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Gretchen. She writes, is neurofeedback training an effective treatment for anxiety, depression, etc.? When I say neurofeedback training, I'm talking about guided exercise for the brain.
I think absolutely neurofeedback therapy. There's also cognitive behavioral therapy. All kinds and forms of psychotherapy can be effective. And many studies have shown that the brain undergoes rewiring of plasticity with behavioral therapy, neurofeedback therapy. So I think all these are very important ways to help improve the functioning of your brain and also to be in charge of the your pain, for example, for neurofeedback or anxiety. So all these should be explored, and all these approaches are changing the brain's function and plasticity, and they're very important.
Is there anything that you can't do anymore? It's just a matter of time and getting approval. And people who have been diagnosed with, let's talk about the real, you know, ADHD cases, autism, any number of things that trouble people.
Well, we have to link it to the advances in neuroscience. So neuroscience discoveries and innovation are growing exponentially.
Right.
It's one of the hottest areas of medicine right now. And the more we learn about the neuroscience and what happens in these conditions, the more we can help patients, whether it's a simple biofeedback or external or talk therapy that can help the patients, or in the case of those individuals who are severely disabled and the medications and anything else is not helping them, a brain pacemaker or an external pacemaker may be an option. So it's really an exciting time for us to be able to help many patients whom we could not help before.
Last time we talked, about a year and a half ago, you were doing two or three of these surgeries a week. Is that still the case? What's changed? If not, what's changed?
Well, no, we were doing more of these surgeries a week. And as time goes along, these surgeries are becoming more simpler. For example, 15, 16 years ago, when we were doing this in Europe, where I was training in Canada, it took us many hours, 12 to 18 hours, to do one side of the brain. Now, for example, we had a surgery done last week that took us an hour to do this. So these brain implants are being done in an hour, hour and a half. And there's now an FDA-approved procedure that allows you to do it in outpatient MRI. So these procedures, I would say, within a few years can be done with same-day surgery.
Let's see. Tamar from Columbus. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, is it possible to use deep brain stimulation or any of the other things that you're talking about to treat multiple system atrophy?
Which is Dr. Rezai?
Yes, that's a very difficult condition that basically involves multiple parts of the nervous system are damaged, and it can mimic Parkinson's and can cause dementia and can cause a lot of problems. Unfortunately, we're not able to help those patients. We've done some initial work, but we need to do more research in this area.
Do you know why it doesn't work with that?
The pathophysiology of that is very different than Parkinson's. So many conditions can mimic Parkinson's, but the main one that gets better with surgery is the typical garden variety, what we call the idiopathic Parkinson's, or Parkinson's that responds to medications. So unfortunately, some of these other syndromes that mimic Parkinson's that are more rare, unfortunately, we can't help them with this surgery.
Tamar, thank you so much for your call. My guest is Dr. Ali Rezai. He is director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. We'll continue the conversation after this. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Ali Rezai. He's the director of the Center for Neuromodulation at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about deep brain stimulation and also other ways that these pacemaker-type devices are being used installed in the neck, installed in the jaw, you name it, depending on what the impairment is, what the problem is. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Rezai, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You assemble quite a team of physicians and nurses throughout an array of specialties, including psychiatry. Where does that come into play?
Well, this teamwork is extremely important. So that's what we establish here at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. So, for example, a patient who's got Parkinson's, they come into the Center for Neuromodulation, and they're seen by multiple individuals. They're seen by a neurologist who's an expert in Parkinson's to make sure that the medications are optimized. They are seen by psychologists. Often Parkinson's or other conditions can affect your anxiety, can cause depression, can cause mood issues. They're seen by rehabilitation doctors so they can look at how their walking can be improved, how their speech, how their life situation can be improved. We have social workers, and we do imaging of the brain so that patients get a comprehensive assessment from head to toe. And then we have patient conferences where we sit down with all the physicians and all the caretakers and review each patient in great detail to come up with a personalized approach, whether it's adjustment of medications, whether it's more physical therapy, whether it's having speech therapy, or whether doing more exercise, diet, social work input, or if necessary, surgery. So this multidisciplinary, including having psychiatrists and psychologists, is extremely important because it's not only your physical disability. Patients also have emotional disability. They get life disabilities. So we have to be able to treat the entire patient. It's not just teaching, helping improve the tremor. We have to help the patients get reintegrated into life, going back to work. So we have to treat the whole patient.
That's not always been the case with medicine. That's a relatively new concept. Probably, in a way, good that things have taken the time they have, because psychiatry and all of the way we cope with emotional disabilities and that sort of thing, depression, all of it has changed a lot in the last 20 years too.
Absolutely. And it's extremely important to treat the whole human being. So the emotional well-being is very important for everybody, the physical well-being, the cognitive well-being. And a lot of these conditions are chronic, and these patients become slowly and progressively disabled. They lose the control over life. They have difficulty taking care of their families and loved ones. And it's very important to help patients to be able to have the best approach to regain the control over their life. And having a multidisciplinary, comprehensive approach that not only looks at the physical disability of a tremor, but also the emotional disability, the cognitive, the job disability. So it's absolutely vital for future medicine that we're helping patients to deal with all elements of life. And that's where teams come in to help patients and families.
Joe in Sunbury, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. I'm on a cell phone. You hear me?
You sound pretty good, yeah.
Okay. My husband is 80 years old, has RRMS, and one of the side effects, of course, is severe incontinence. Walking is a problem. Is there any hope for someone in that age bracket with that particular disease?
What is RRMS? Multiple sclerosis, but what's the RR part? Joe?
It's remitting.
Relapsing.
Remitting, relapsing. Okay.
Yes.
So this is a MS, as you know, is a very progressive disability, and the brain keeps on changing. And MS, depending on what part of the brain and nervous system it's attacking, unfortunately, can cause in many things, can cause cognitive problems, can cause spasticity, can cause movement problems, can cause incontinence. There are ways where we can help patients who have severe spasticity from the MS of the muscles or incontinence, but it's very complicated and we need to have a comprehensive evaluation. But yes, these pacemakers can help those with severe incontinence or spasticity, but the patient needs to be carefully evaluated with MS because it's a very complicated overall condition.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for that call. You said because MS, the brain is constantly changing with MS, that therein lies one of the greater challenges.
Exactly.
You put the wire in one place, not everywhere.
That's exactly right. And MS is very challenging because it's constantly evolving. And it's one of the most difficult conditions for us to treat. But with regards to the MS spasticity, we have this procedure called the baclofen pump. So we insert a microinfusion device that delivers the medication to the nerves to release the spasm of the nerves. So the patients have less spasms, spasticity, they can function better. So it's not only pacemakers that we implant, but also we implant microinfusion devices. And this is another technology that's going to have a major potential by delivering drugs or stem cells or gene therapy to specific parts of the brain using this technology.
Jenny in Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Thank you for your time. I have two quick questions. My 58-year-old brother had a severe left-sided stroke a year and a half ago. He has right hemiparesis. He also is unable to communicate. He has just one word, one. That's all he says, one. Otherwise healthy, has many, many years to live in this condition, not very motivated to do therapy and physical therapy, speech therapy. He just refuses all of it. Is there any hope with your new research here that could help him?
At this point, the neurostimulation of pacemakers for stroke is in early clinical trials worldwide, so we have to wait and see what the final outcomes are for stroke. But I think there's a number of options if your brother is seen by a stroke specialist to see how we can facilitate movement recoveries, muscle recovery, and potentially speech recovery. But, you know, it's difficult to know what part of the brain is damaged. We have to see the details. Mm-hmm. But there are options, but surgically we have to wait. At this point, it's early clinical trials that are exploring the movement improvements after stroke or speech or behavioral improvements.
Thanks a lot, Jenny, for that call. I read that the wire acts as sort of a microphone and that you use it to listen to the neurons in the patient's brain as the patient moves around, drinks a glass of water. What are you hearing? And I know you have recordings. We don't have one for the show today, but can you kind of describe what you actually hear?
Right. So during surgery, we have these test electrodes, these tiny wires the size of a hair that are placed in the brain and put inside the brain with a micro robot. And these wires are allowing us to listen to the activity of neurons or the brain cells. And as the neurons are talking to each other, we're listening to neurons talking to each other. And depending on what part of the brain is, if you're in a part that Parkinson's damaged, then the language of neurons is different. So there's a language of Parkinson's. There's a language involved for tremor. There's an area involved for anxiety, for mood. So we're able to sample and listen to different parts of the brain and see where these neurons are malfunctioning so we can identify the spot that we need to implant the pacemaker. And that's part of the mapping process done during surgery.
So what does it sound like? Is there anything else like it in the world that you can compare it to?
Well, some people say it sounds like static or popcorn popping, but it's music to my ears. I know exactly where we are, our team, our physiologist, our neurology team. We know exactly where we are depending on the sounds. But to the
The wire is, as it's moving through the brain, you hear different sounds?
Exactly. It's like going from one country to another. And as we travel from one country to another, you can hear people speaking different languages. People look different, the environment's different, and that's how we're able to map the different parts of the brain. So, for example, within a few millimeters apart, you're traversing dozens of areas in the brain dozens of regions. So we look for the area that's, for example, causing the tremor, the area causing the pain, the area causing the anxiety. And that mapping is an important part of this.
Of course, we're talking about the human brain right now, but when you talk about neurons talking to each other, are we kind of anthropomorphizing there? Are they really talking to each other? Is that what you see it as?
Yes, the neurons are constantly communicating. Your brain is filled with hundreds of billions of neurons that define your individual self-being, your consciousness, being able to think, being able to see, smell, hear, and conduct your activities. So the neurons are constantly talking in this beautiful dynamic brain, which is an amazing organ, the most amazing organ in the known universe.
Which brings up another topic to mind that I wanted to make sure I got to, and that's treatment in animals, in pets, in domesticated, I mean, animals, period. Not just as test cases, but also to help them.
Well, there's a lot of research looking at pets and, for example, anxiety in pets and others. So using maybe the pet collar as a way to help relax the pets a little bit from separation anxiety or others. So again, the same thing, a lot of the conditions involving pets and other animal conditions are also nervous system disorders that may potentially be treated to help pets live better lives and interact better with their owners and loved ones.
Is that just in the test stage now?
This is in the test stage.
Not
right
at
now,
your
yes.
local vet yet. an email from Babs. She writes, I saw a CoSi exhibit in the fall. It was all about the brain, and I learned that babies have terrific wiring. Over time, if these pathways are not reinforced, they go away, for example, language abilities. So environment has a lot to do with stimulation for these babies, relating to how much time is spent stimulating these pathways. My question is this. Will there be a cell phone app to stimulate babies in the future? If so, it would be a long way to help improve a child's performance, no matter where they are born or how they are treated. Interesting.
Very interesting. I think the baby and young individual's brain, and for that matter, at all levels of your life, your brain is constantly changing. Obviously, when you're younger and babies, it's got the most potential. It's like a sponge, and it's very dynamic in response to the environment. So the more you're able to improve the connection with the environment, the more you're able to modulate the brain. So yes, apps or other, you know, talk about music in the brain and many other areas. And it's really the maximization of the interaction with the brain. For example, when you're younger, you have a lot of potential for many languages. So the brain is very dynamic. And that's the beauty of the brain. It's dynamic, it's plastic.
When you listen to the brain of the 7-year-old that you operated on versus the 91-year-old, do they, going through the same places, sound differently?
Actually, no. They sound the same. It's very interesting. The neurons in the areas that we were sampling to put the pacemaker, they were similar. Their lack of activity or their malfunction or chaos was similar in a young individual, causing them to have movement problems versus a 91-year-old. So it's the same malfunction.
Email from Mark in Worthington. Can this treatment work for the neurological symptoms of tinnitus?
That's a
great
question.
Could you tell us what tinnitus is?
Yes, tinnitus, is ringing in the ear, very common, affects 25 million plus individuals. And often is fine as a mild ringing in the ear, but it can be very severe and disabling in a small subset of these individuals. So yes, there are actual clinical trials being done worldwide in several centers looking at pacemakers that are able to muffle the tinnitus or the severe ringing in those who have severe tinnitus. So yes, absolutely.
I guess this kind of goes back to a question I've already asked, but I guess I have to ask it again, is how do you decide what isn't being studied now as far as this potential?
Well, there's a lot of potential, but I think the key thing here is it has to do with clinical trials. For example, Parkinson's or chronic pain, these approaches have been going on for over a decade. In fact, for Parkinson's and brain pacemaker, there's a 30-year-plus safety track record and over 100,000 patient implants. In the case of the traumatic brain injury, we're doing clinical trials at Ohio State, or we'd be doing clinical trials for obesity or alcoholism or patients with Alzheimer's. These are very early trials. So this have to be continue to be observed patients, and we have to enroll more patients and see how it happens over the next few years. If the results are strong and robust, then I think it can become a normal therapy like we do for Parkinson's. So tinnitus and Alzheimer's and autism and brain injury, these are all hope that we have to help in these patients, but it requires years of clinical trials. It's not trivial. And in the case of Parkinson's, we did those clinical trials in the 1990s and so on. So now it's routine treatments. And we need to continue the clinical trials and see if we can help these patients more.
Can we talk a little bit about the robots that you were mentioning earlier? How big are they? And what do you mean by, I mean, I know that they're automated in some way, but what are they doing?
Right. So these are very tiny micro robots that basically deliver the brain pacemaker to the...
They just grab that little...
Yes. And they're tiny. And basically we drive the robot slowly because... Yeah, these pacemaker surgery is very precise. If we put it in the wrong place, or if we're off by a couple of millimeters, you're in the wrong place in the brain. So it's probably one of the most precise surgeries there is. And that's why we do all the mapping, so we can listen to the right area and find the exact spot. And that's why we use the micro-robot technology to help us deliver to the exact location in the brain, so we're very precise and put it exactly where it needs to be to help patients.
And I know that you've held some 10 or more patents involving this work. What are some of the things you've designed that I guess mere mortals would understand in terms of deep brain stimulation?
Well, we're looking at different ways of using sensors, for example. So this whole world of sensors that's changing all of medicine. You have sensors now that can detect your movements, sensors, for example, for anxiety, and sensors for many things. So we're looking at the use of sensors to help you and an individual be aware of their functioning. Some sensors that can detect tremor, sensors that can detect...
These could be like the same sort of things that detect how many hours you slept last night, those
Absolutely.
Same kind of things?
Okay. Absolutely. These are external sensors. There's a lot of activity being done. And a lot of people in Ohio and our colleagues, for example, at the Air Force Research Lab at Dayton, they're world's experts at sensors for the military. Battelle Corporation, they have tremendous work they're doing with sensors. So we are leveraging the tremendous expertise in the state of Ohio and trying to link all this research done to help patients. And the cell phone technology I talked to you about earlier, mm-hmm. using a cell phone to stop cluster headaches or migraine headaches, that's technology that came out of our research that allows us to take a microimplant that can be injected in different parts of the body, and these implants can be activated and monitored with your cell phone. So this cell phone that we all have, and as you know, there are more cell phones in the world than shoes.
Smartphones.
Smartphones, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is universal. So your smartphone can be used to monitor your brain function or monitor your body function, and it can also be used as a therapeutic tool to help you improve your function.
It's been about a year and a half since we last talked. Should I wait that long again, or is this something that is happening? How do you stay focused when so much is happening with it?
It's really an exciting time right now in neuroscience. I mean, at Ohio State, for example, there are over 900 students who are majoring in neurosciences. It is very hot. There's a lot of activity in the world of neurosciences. So it's the brain is the final frontier. So it's exciting. There's so much going on in understanding the brain networks. There's the President Obama had the Brain Initiative last year, $100 million being poured into brain research. European Union is putting $1.3 billion into brain research. The Canadian government is putting $100 million, over $2 billion in philanthropy over the past couple of years being poured into brain research. We are learning more how we can, with this research and innovation, how we can unlock the mysteries of the brain to help patients. I mean, you have people who have Alzheimer's. 5 million people have Alzheimer's. 3 million have epilepsy. Many have stroke. People have Parkinson's disease. There are many, many neurological conditions. In fact, worldwide, we have over 1 billion people who have neurological disorders. In the U.S., 100 million, and the cost worldwide is $1 trillion. So it's imperative for us to understand more about the neuroscience and help patients. And it's exciting, and that's why there's so many teams involved working together.
Well, hopefully we have you on again soon, and we can maybe listen to the sound of the neurons next time.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure being here.
Thanks for joining us. That's Dr. Ali Rezai. He's director of the Center for Neuromodulation at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.